not such a clever one about the latest fads.
Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we chat with Kathleen Chalfant. We review the Broadway production of Misery, the public's production of The First Order Suite, and Laura Benanti at NJ PAC. That plus some news. Please stay tuned.
I'm the type that they classify as quaint.
Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, November 22nd, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Carrie Purcell. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Hello. Also with us is Carrie Purcell. Carrie is a staff writer and features editor at Playbill.com. Her column, A Woman's World, focuses on covering women's issues both on and off Broadway by highlighting successful women in the industry and the challenge they have faced. She can be followed on Twitter at Carrie Purcell and at her blog, conveniently named CarriePurcell.com. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
And I think that congratulations are in order. Aren't you the newest member of the Women in Theater?
Oh, the League of Professional Theater Women. Yes, I just got my acceptance letter this week.
Awesome sauce.
Thank you.
We love that. Do you photocopy it, send it home to mom to hang on the fridge?
My mom's already liked it on Facebook, so I think that's
the new way. Mom on Facebook. I can't get my mom on Facebook. She just,
oh, no, my mom got herself on Facebook.
Oh, that's awesome. With us today, we have a very special guest joining us by phone. Kathleen Chalfant is with us, and Broadway fans know Kathleen from Angels in America, City Center's encore series of Bloomer Girl, Racing Demon, Dance With Me, M. Butterfly, and of course, off-Broadway in Wit, as well as just a long list of amazing productions, one after the other. Kathleen, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So you are starring as Rose Kennedy in a show called Rose down at the Theater Row. And you just, was last night the first preview?
Yes, it was.
So even more props to you for getting up on a Sunday and helping us. So tell us about Rose.
Rose is a play written by a journalist named Lawrence Lamer, who's written quite a lot about the Kennedys and a number of other things too, and who actually has a book coming out about Morris Dees from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the fall. So, but this is his first play, and it's a one-woman play about Rose Kennedy, and it's set in the week after Chappaquiddick, so 1969.
So in preparing for this, there is so much, both in video and fiction and nonfiction, about the Kennedys. What did you do to prepare for this role?
Well, what I often try to do is to. This seems like a silly thing to say, but I read the play because it's sometimes dangerous to do too much research, because then you begin to do the play you would have written. Rather than the play that's on the page, and keep saying, well, do you know this, and she did this, and all like that. So the first thing I did was to read the play, and then Larry sent me a lot of supporting material, including a wonderful book called Rose Kennedy's Photograph Album. And then I listened quite a lot to Robert McNeil's interview with Rose Kennedy in 1974, which covers a lot of the same material. It's 5 years after this play is set, But that was enormously helpful because I could both hear how she sounded, which was very particular, and also see how she looked. And there were a couple of things, a couple of moments in the television thing that were almost exactly what's in the play. So that was very helpful. Props to YouTube for helping you find anything you need. Mrs. Google is our go-to person.
I remember that she was on the Merv Griffin show.
Yes, she was.
When I was a child, but she was already past 80. I remember him referring to that. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I really got to hear and see her. But also, I guess it's just a happy coincidence, Kathleen. There are two new books about Rosemary Kennedy.
Yes, it is. We began working on this play a year ago before those books were even thought of. So it is a happy coincidence. And the story of Rosemary is central, I think, to the psychic life of the family. And, of course, one of the great accomplishments of the Kennedy family, which is its work with the mentally retarded, particularly under Eunice's leadership. The thing that most people know is the Special Olympics, but there's all kinds of other, any number of other initiatives. And in fact, Jack Kennedy was the first person to put forward legislation in his presidency dealing with mental retardation. So it's a very central issue in their lives.
Well, that's one of the saddest stories I've ever read.
It's just heartbreaking and almost unbelievable, actually.
Yeah.
Before you got cast in this role, had you had any affinity for the Kennedy family and the Kennedy lore?
Well, it was I grew up with them. You know, I was born in 1945, so Jack Kennedy was the president when I was at the end of my high school years, and when I was in college, I was in a sophomore in college when he was assassinated, I lived on through the 60s through Bobby's death, and I've then watched what began in many ways as yet another tragedy, which is Teddy and Chappaquiddick, and the way in which he became, in his terribly flawed way, a great senator, perhaps one of the, in many ways, Teddy and Eunice are the people in the family, you could say, who accomplished the most, partly because they lived so long and worked so hard.
So tell us about the history of Kathleen. Where are you from?
I was born in San Francisco in 1945. My dad was in the war in the Pacific, and I grew up in the Bay Area, finally we moved in the sixth grade. We moved to Oakland on Fruitvale Avenue, which is famous for Fruitvale Station. Mm-hmm. And I went to high school, junior high school and high school in Oakland, and then I went to Stanford. And then I got married. In the 60s, you weren't supposed to get married, but I got married when I was 21, and I'm still married to the same person.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thanksgiving will be our 49th wedding anniversary.
Unimaginable. Congratulations.
Also unimaginable for a child of the 60s. But there you go.
And how did you end up crossing the United States, end up in New York and on the stage?
Well, I never actually wanted to do anything else my whole life. When I was a little kid, I had a much older brother who was 14 years older, and he worked in the theater a lot. He ran a ballet company for a while. He was a great lover of opera, and he brought the theater in a very real way into our family. He had lots of friends who were actors and things like that. And I used to go to the movies with my grandmother, and then act out the movies in our backyard because it was just me.
Sure.
Though I, in the early on, I really wanted to be in the cowboy movies because I loved horses, and I thought maybe I'd get kissed that way. But and so that's what I really wanted to do. I was always in, you know, in the school plays and all like that. But when I went to college, I didn't study the theater, though I sort of meant to, but I didn't. And I ended up, for all sorts of complicated reasons, mostly having to do with my boyfriend, not the person I'm married to, as it happens, studying classical Greek.
Oh, my
and
God.
I'd graduated a little bit early, and I was supposed to go on to graduate school, and I was riding in the car with the person to whom I am now married, and said I didn't really want to spend the rest of my life teaching Greek to prep school boys. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I always wanted to be an actress. And he said, well, why don't you do that? Mm. And so I sort of did. And in a kind of not a direct way. I didn't go to graduate school for acting, which I'm sorry that I didn't do, because it would have been provided a great education but I'd have come at it in a different way. And so my husband and I then moved to Europe for a while, and then we ended up in New York. He was a sculptor. He's now a documentarian, best known for his work in street art. We ended up in New York in 1973, and I began studying with Wynn Handman, who's a
yes.
great teacher who's still teaching now today in his 90s. And then I just began working really on new plays in New York for a long time. So I didn't ever really do Shakespeare until the middle 90s. my first Shakespeare in public, which was Henry V in the Park.
Wow, that's trial by fire there.
it was not an obvious way to get here, but I've been extraordinarily lucky in the work I've been allowed to do. So
we should mention that Kathleen has a very talented daughter who is a set designer. Andromache, is that how you say it?
Andromache.
Andromache
Chalfant. Andromache Chalfant, yes.
But you call her Andy, isn't that right?
No, we don't.
Oh,
actually,
I thought I heard
you right. When we named her Andromache, we said we would never call her Andy, and we never did. So she had another nickname that I won't say for all the time that she was growing up, and now she's called Andromache.
Okay.
By everyone. We call her Honey in the family. But
what's the root of that name?
Andromache it's a Greek name.
And I was thinking, yeah.
It comes from the Iliad. Andromache was Hector's wife, mm-hmm. the Trojan hero's wife. And there's a play called The Andromache. She didn't have a very happy life, but we didn't sort of think that through. We thought, we thought, oh, who's nice? Because we didn't want to name her Cassandra, because at the time that she was born, there were all sort of girls named Cassandra, and we knew that wasn't so happy. So we thought, oh, Andromache was great. She was Hector's wife and everything, but of course Hector was killed, and her child was thrown off the walls of Troy, and then she was taken
the end
as
it.
A slave to by Agamemnon. So it's all right. My daughter's life has been happier than that.
At least you didn't call her Electra or Medea.
No.
So I want to delve into some of the things in your past, if you'll indulge me for a few minutes. Let's talk about Angels in America, which just was the first time I had seen you on stage, and it changed so many lives.
It was an incredible privilege to be part of that, the making of that play. I can remember I'd known Tony from the New York Theater Workshop because I'd done some work there. And one, it was the spring of 1988. We lived on the Upper West Side then. We were walking on the Upper West Side, and my husband and I ran into Tony, and he said, "You know, I'm writing this play, and there's a part for you in it." And I thought, "Oh well, isn't that nice? Okay." And then in the fall of 1988, I was by Larry Kramer called Just Say No. And Tony said, "You know that play I told you about? We're doing a reading of it at the New York Workshop. Could you come?" And I came, and I was a little bit late, and so I didn't have time to deal with all the everything that people say at the beginning. And I opened this, and he said to me, "Okay, so you're playing the rabbi, the doctor, and the Mormon mother, and Ethel Rosenberg. Okay, okay." And then we started, and of course the first line of the play is, "Hello and good morning. I am the Rebbe Isidore Chemovitz from the Bronx Home for Aged Hebrews." And out came the Rebbe of my mouth. And I was as surprised as everybody else. And it was only many years later that I realized that the Rebbe had been born in my head in Mr. Kitzel, from the Jack Benny show that I had listened to when I was a little kid. I really realized, oh, the Rebbe sounds quite a lot like Mr. Kitzel. And anyway, that was the beginning. And I was, Ellen McLaughlin and Stephen Spinella and I were Ellen and Stephen were involved even before I was in the early work on the play in San Francisco. And then we began this sort of slight, often changing core of people working on the play. Oscar Eustace, who'd commissioned the play, went from San Francisco to the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. And so we did almost all the developmental work on the play in Los Angeles. And so it was sort of like our regular job, you know, a couple times a year we'd go out and see what was going on, work on the play. It was extraordinary, actually. And so the world premiere of the play was in San Francisco and directed by David S. Bjornson, and that was quite wonderful. And we did, Millennium was all written and Perestroika was being written, and so for the Perestroika part, we did what was often a five-hour staged reading. So then we'd shorten, you know, we'd take parts out and there would be narrative bridges. And then sometimes we'd put those parts back in because there was a wonderful scene between Joe and Lewis about Thurgood Marshall that didn't ever make it into the final play, but Thurgood Marshall died while we were doing this incense, so we put the Thurgood Marshall part back in for a while. And then it went to Los Angeles for production of both parts at the Taper, and then we came to Broadway. I'm trying to think. 1993, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Ellen and I were the last members of the original company to leave. And we left in 1994.
So I don't know if this has happened before. Unfortunately, Peter Felicia is away this weekend and wasn't able to join us, but he would know definitely. Maybe one of the others knows. Has there ever been a Broadway cast that is performing at night and then developing another show underneath it to
during the day
in which you
I
guys,
don't know
eventually you played in rep I,
we did we played we opened Millennium for one season, and as soon as we were open and playing, we began rehearsing Perestroika, so we were just lived in the theater, actually. And then when both plays were ready, we alternated. I think what we did was to We did two, seems to me like we did two weekend marathons. I think we alternated during the week and then did the whole play Saturday and Sunday. I'm not sure that that's right, but it seems right. I know that there were two marathon days. It was, you know, it was amazing. People used to come with their parents to Millennium and then go out and come out at their meals and then come back to Perestroika. It was an extraordinary experience, and it was a safe place for people. And we always thought, you know, when we got to Broadway, the audience was much more mainstream, and we always thought that at least for 7 hours, some people thought something they'd never thought before.
Absolutely.
And you must be changed by that in some way.
I brought somebody who I was dating at the time, who from an Upper East Side family that is very conservative, and I thought for sure she was going to break up after the play. And she really enjoyed it, I think it changed her point of view for the rest of her life. I think, you know, it was that kind of play that had that type of an impact on the audience.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, we watched the audience, and all kinds of things happened. But quite often, especially in the smaller theaters where we could really see people, you'd often see lone women sitting in the first row weeping, and we thought, Ellen got this idea, and it seemed to make sense, that these were the aunts in families who were in some way, the people who understood their gay nieces and nephews, you know, they were the ally in the family.
Ah.
And one time on Broadway, during the curtain call, there was almost always a standing ovation, and in about the third row, this woman stood up to applaud. And her husband began dragging her out of the row. It was really wild. That was wild.
Well, there were so many extraordinary scenes in that play, but I think maybe the death of Roy Cohn, that has to rank up there with just really an extraordinary scene.
So from one play with emotional impact on the audience to another play with emotional impact was your performance in Wit, where I can't even tell you the audience, you know, going from one extreme to another during, you know, 90 minutes or 110 minutes or so of the show. Tell us about Wit.
Well, Wit, Wit came to me in that kind of way that things sometimes come to you in the theater. This famous production of Henry V in the park was directed by Doug Hughes, and his assistant director was Derek Anson Jones. And I knew Derek from the New York Theater Workshop, and also in sort of from around, we had friends in common, and he and Dennis O'Hare were a couple, and I'd been in a play with Dennis, so I knew Derek from that. And so while we were doing the play, Derek gave me this play, and he said, "Would you read this play and see what you think?" And he gave me Wit, and as it happened, my brother, who had just been diagnosed with cancer, was visiting at the time, and he was, as I said, my theatrical mentor in many ways. And so I read the play, and I called Derek, and I thought that he wanted me to play the other part, the part that Helen Stenborg played, because I couldn't imagine that you would have this play and not have someone to play the part. And so there was a sort of awkward conversation, and they said, no, it's Vivian Baring. So I then gave it to my brother to ask him whether it was true to his experience of the disease, and he came down weeping and said, yes, it was. And he said, then there's this other thing, if anybody ever asks you to do this, you better do it.
Good advice.
Yeah. And so through a whole series of things about 6 months later, Doug Hughes, who was briefly at the Guthrie, came to take over the Long Wharf Theater, and he and Derek had given him the play, and he wanted to do it as the first new play in the small theater at the Long Wharf when he reopened the, when he took over. And so Derek directed it there, and it did very well, and then moved to New York under the auspices of MCC. And then we moved finally to a commercial production on 17th Street. And I think that it's a wonderful play, but I think the thing that made it more than that was Derek's production. He was an extraordinary director, and everybody's always awful nice about my performance, but I think it's Derek's production that made the play what it was, and anybody who played that part, as you saw by the people who came afterward, were wonderful actors by virtue both of the part and the production.
And having Helen Stenborg was...
And having Helen. Having Helen was the best of all. That was Doug's present, his mom.
Yes.
Kathleen, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us. I want to remind our listeners that Kathleen is starring as Rose Kennedy in Rose down at the Theater Rose Clurman Theater through December 13th. We'll have information about that production on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com. And Kathleen, I want to wish you a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Let's jump into a little bit of reviews today. Carrie talked last week about Misery, the play starring Laurie Metcalf and some other guy. And Michael and I got a chance to see it this week, and I'm so glad Carrie's come back to join in the conversation. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what you thought about Misery?
I enjoyed it much more than I expected to. I thought that the adaptation by William Goldman was excellent. I was in a weird position because I did see the movie when it came out, but that was so long ago that I had forgotten almost everything. I mean, I remember the basic setup. I remembered a couple of key lines, and I remembered that, you know, central action that she takes at one point. So I certainly remember that keep the writer at bay or in his bed or whatever. But I had forgotten so much of it, so it was kind of neat that I was able to have the mystery sort of unfold for me again, or mystery or whatever you want. It's almost like a horror movie in some ways. But basically, it's a psychological character study, as we discussed last week, of this obsessed, crazed fan, and how she deals with this writer whom she reveres when he happens to fall into her clutches. I thought that the have either of you read the book?
No, I have not.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do that because I'm so curious as to – somebody told me that in the book that the character of Misery, the fictional character of Misery, plays a much larger role. I think there's actual chapters of the book that he's writing in the book. That's what I'm told. It sounds really, really fascinating, so I'm going to have to check that out.
Sounds like it's fascinating, but I don't know how you would stage that. You know, if
well, actually, no, exactly, which was why they didn't.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, I thought that and when you think about if you've just seen the movie, you could, in a way, you could certainly understand why someone would want to make it into a play because it's very few characters. That this version has only three characters: the those two, and then the police officer who showed the sheriff or who shows up a couple of times. And it's all takes place within and immediately outside of this house that Annie Wilkes owns in some somewhat remote location. Colorado, yes. I thought, needless to say, Laurie Metcalf was amazing. At one point, I don't even remember when it was, but at one point about halfway, I turned to my friend who I was with and I said, "She's incredible." And he said, "Yes, she really is." But Bruce Willis, I thought there were some places where it seemed to me that he really could have had more energy. Towards the beginning, especially, I had a couple of places where I had difficulty hearing him. And I had to kind of, I almost found myself leaning forward a little bit. It's tough because he's supposed to play someone who, especially at the beginning, is in very, very bad shape. He's just had a very traumatic accident. So you have to communicate that, but at the same time, you still have to be heard. A couple of times I did have a problem with that. There was one moment when, I don't know if this happened when, well, I know James and I saw the same performance, but do you remember this, James? At one point, she strikes him and he cries out in pain and the audience laughed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that's because he didn't do it well or just if it was just nervous laughter. What did you think?
I thought it was nervous laughter because it was kind of, you know, she was striking him out of anger. And and he was already so badly hurt. I think that that's what kind of I read it as.
Yeah, yeah. But I thought the set was really quite something, David Korins. And I thought I felt that Will Frears directed it very well. I there was definitely a sense of tension and not you really not knowing what was going to happen next. And I'm kind of glad that I forgot most of the movie because I really appreciated experiencing all that almost anew. So I really enjoyed it. I would highly recommend it. I thought I was skeptical. I wasn't sure if I was going to like it, although I knew I would like I kind of expected to like Laurie Metcalf. I would say that Bruce Willis's Broadway debut is creditable and nothing to be embarrassed about, and he had some really good moments in it as well.
So last week, Carrie, you talked about the important role that the music played in it. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I was like, you hit the nail right on the head for me, at least, absolutely, that I was like, wow, this really adds so much. And it highlighted a sadness that the Tony Awards Committee has eliminated sound design as a category because this was so I couldn't imagine this play being as good as it was without that sound design.
I was a big band nerd in middle and high school, and often when people would try to cut the funding for the local school's arts, we would say, go watch a horror movie without the sound and then tell me if you're scared.
Yeah.
And I just kept thinking of that while watching the play.
What did you play?
I played the clarinet in band.
Did you ever go to band camp?
I didn't have a choice. we had to do marching band camp for 2 weeks in the summer in South Carolina in a parking lot. It was lovely. But I am so glad that music was a part of my education, and watching Misery was a huge reminder of just how crucial it is. Because I mean, Laurie still would have been terrifying,
yeah,
for sure. But the music added so much to that play.
I was remiss in not mentioning it. It's by Michael Friedman, who probably most famous for Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, but has also done a lot of shows with the Civilians, including I guess Pretty Filthy was the most recent one.
Yeah,
I think that it's interesting to think about how it probably happened. There are scenes, fairly long scenes with no dialogue, like when Bruce Willis finally ventures out of the bed into the wheelchair and goes into the kitchen to try to figure out what he's going to do. And if that had been in silence, I think it would have probably not worked very well. So I imagine that maybe William Goldman or whoever said to themselves, well, we really need to get somebody to write some music to cover, to accompany those sections. And so they did. And I agree that it added a tremendous amount to the show.
Michael, we had Michael Friedman on the podcast.
Yes.
This summer, was it? He was doing Fortress of Solitude, the Shikaboom release or Ghostlight release, whichever it was.
Right, and that was also around the time of Pretty Filthy, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. That's what triggered it in my memory. That's right. Yeah. So I will put a link in the show notes back to our interview with Michael Friedman. I guess June 21st, 2015. I will try to get that into the show notes. But yeah, I totally forgot that he had he was doing this. I think he mentioned it in the interview as well. So I really loved this show. It was it combines a bunch of my favorite things about a show. It's a 7 p.m. start, 90 minutes and no intermission. It was really, just shows you I'm getting old. Can't do those late nights anymore. But it was really wonderful. Laurie Metcalf was amazing. I think they need to reorder the billing on the thing. She should be above Bruce Willis's name. What I see on was it Michael Dale? From Broadway World that wrote, I saw this show and it had this Bruce Laurie Willis Metcalf in it, or because the way the marquee is listed.
Oh, is it?
It looks like it's they put Bruce Willis horizontally across the top and Laurie Metcalf below it. But if you read the names up down the way you usually read them on a marquee, it says Bruce Laurie Willis Metcalf. But highly recommend it. Even my friends who are Stephen King fans who have read the books are coming out saying that this was very good. Laurie Metcalf has got, you know, she's got total control over that. That just somebody who's unspooling, you know, right in front of your eyes, but not like beyond over the top unbelievable.
Right.
It just unspooled enough to make you really frightened. And so I recommend it heartily. I thought it was great. I thought that Bruce Willis did well. I don't think that there's a lot that could be asked of somebody in that role, most of the show being in bed. And another aspect of it that's interesting is that I think, is this Warner Brothers' first venture into producing theater? I think that it is. I'm not positive about that.
Sure.
But if Warner Brothers is going to get further into it, and Castle Rock Entertainment, who I believe produced the film, so hopefully we'll see more things.
I hope they're as well done as this one was.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've seen so many of those that weren't. But really, I mean, I'm sure you guys would say the same thing. I was so conscious of the audience just being so into it, you know, so wrapped.
Oh, Michael, talking about the audience, because you were there at the same performance.
Yeah.
Two people in the front row got up in the middle of the show.
Two people
Different ends of the front row got up.
Came
back. So they went to the bathroom or made a phone call or something. I could not believe it.
Well, except
people were taking photos with the flash.
Oh yeah,
I was at.
Oh God, really?
Yeah.
Well, except for those people.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that the audience just was really, really, really.
No, I think the audience really loved it. And Will Frears, who I think this was his Broadway debut for directing. Michael, do you know if that's true?
Off the top of my head, yes.
I think that's his Broadway debut for directing. He's directed a lot of off-Broadway stuff, and I look forward to his next thing because this was a story well told and well directed, and the sets that you mentioned, and this whole package was very, very good, so I highly recommend it.
Yep.
All right. Michael, you got a chance to see Laura Benanti.
Yes.
She told... You know,
she corrected us
because I said Laura Benanti, and she said Benanti. I'm Laura Benanti from New Jersey.
You said Benanti because I said Benanti.
Yeah.
So there again, I was wrong.
And she was at NJ PAC. So tell us, Laura Benanti in concert. What's that like?
She did two shows last night, the 21st, in the Chase Room, they call it, which is actually, it's basically a function room, I think, but they have it set up very nicely as a cabaret space. It's kind of similar to the Appel Room in the sense that the performers are backed by huge windows looking out, outside, and so it creates a nice sense of space, and it's very lovely. And she did, she is so great. I love her so much. Her voice is so amazing, and she's also, I think, one of the funniest people on the face of the earth. She told a lot of stories about her grandmother and people she's worked with, and a really wonderful story about how wonderful Cheetah Rivera was to her during Nine with Antonio Banderas, so supportive of her. There was a wonderful mix of different types of music, the musical theater stuff. She opened with Ice Cream from She Loves Me, which she's going to be doing on Broadway. And that is not an easy song to open with. But for her, it just seemed like a piece of cake. That high note, whatever it is, it's probably like an A or a B flat. She just popped it out and it was incredible. She also did I Could Have Danced All Night. She joked she'd love to do My Fair Lady soon before she has to do it in an arena.
That's hysterical.
And she did Unusual Way from Nine, which is, I think, is one of the most beautiful songs ever. And then she did a lot of, she did a wonderful Harry Chapin song and several other pop numbers. Georgia Stitt was her musical director and pianist, with Brian Ellingson on bass and a woman named Anne Klein, leaping from ukulele to acoustic guitar to electric guitar to banjo, I believe. It was really a wonderful night. I hadn't been to NJ PAC in quite some time, and it was nice to get back there and see something in that space. But I will go to see Laura anywhere, and I can't wait for She Loves Me. Really can't wait.
So we had Laura on a couple of years ago, and we chatted, and I will put a link to that in the show notes as well so that you can listen to that if you'd like to. Also, the Theater People podcast, Patrick Hines had Laura Benanti on a couple of weeks ago in a two-part, two-hour episode.
Wow.
That was really, really wonderful. And so if you are a little bit of a fan of Laura Benanti, I encourage you, get over to the Theater People podcast and listen to it, because it was so good and so interesting and heartwarming, and Laura's had so much, Laura totally, she's an open book, as you can see on her Twitter feed. She talks about anything and everything on Twitter. And, there's when she was, earlier in her career, she missed a lot of shows and missed and had neck surgery during Nine and things like that. Lots of, especially in message boards and chat rooms and things like that, people are vicious and mean on the, whether it be Broadway World or other types of sites that have unmoderated message boards.
Yes.
So vicious, and they say horrible things about her, and she addresses a lot of those things in this two-hour interview with Patrick Hines over at Theater People. So I will link to that as well. And get over there and listen to it. I can't say enough about Laura Benanti. I love her to death. And have you guys seen her in Supergirl, is it?
No, but she talked about that, and she talked about Nashville. She sang a song that she sang in Nashville. And I'm just so happy that she's so hilarious, because it just adds so much to her. Her persona was especially when she's doing a show like this, she's really hysterically funny.
She is.
And so, sometimes if I just need to laugh during the day, I'll just go to her Twitter and scroll through it for a couple minutes.
She could totally have so many different so many different careers. She's so multi-talented. And
she really is.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever saw her live was in 2008's Gypsy, and I was just blown away.
God.
So I want.
I love it when she lapses in back into her Jersey accent. She's always, you know, she's all the Jersey jokes, which, you know, work because she said basically says I can tell those jokes because I actually am from there. You know,
exactly. All right, so the three of us have got a chance to get down to the Public Theater and see the First Daughter Suite. Michael John Lachusa's is that the official pronunciation, Lachusa?
Lachusa.
Lachusa. I always get that wrong.
That one I know.
We got to get Michael John on. He's always really nice and full of great stories.
Yes.
So, Carrie, why don't you start us off with First Daughter Suite?
I loved it. I was a newbie to the concept. I had never seen nor heard First Lady Suite, but had heard quite a bit about it from my friends and was very curious about the production. And I thought it was just outstanding. It was, we had run an interview with Michael on Playbill.com in which he said very clearly, I consider myself a feminist, and explained his fascination with these girls and women who are in the public eye, but not in a position of power the way the presidents are. So the musical is presented in four different scenes at different times, and it also allows characters who would not potentially have met in real life to be interacting. And I found them all to be very different and very unique and also very compassionate towards these women who are very frustrated in some ways. The first one explores a wedding day where tensions are very high, both personally and politically. And my personal favorite was young Amy Carter's Dream, where she's on a boat with several different women and they decide to go on a quite dangerous adventure. And the performances by all the actors were just outstanding. I was really blown away by Betsy Morgan, who played several different roles, and I wouldn't have even known it was the same actress, I don't think, if I hadn't looked at the playbill to see who it was. And Allison Fraser was so compelling playing in Amy Carter's Dream. And I also hope that if there's a biography done of Angela Lansbury one day, that Allison Fraser will star in it, because she looked so much like Angela Lansbury that at times I thought, wait, who's up there? And I just thought it was so gratifying to see these behind the scenes stories be explored. And I would be remiss to not talk about Mary Testa, who is always just a fascinating person to watch on stage, and who was breaking my heart in her scene where she is interacting with the spirit of her dead daughter. And it was a completely different kind of performance than I'd seen from Mary Testa before, and just so sad and so moving. And I love the idea of these untold stories being explored, and have always wondered about the First Daughters. I come from a family that tried to go into politics and didn't, and this musical left me very relieved that my life turned out the way it did.
Yes. Well, I loved it too. I just adored it. You should catch up, Carrie, with First Lady Suite at some point, if only on record, I guess. You can do it that way. I was wondering if maybe some of these pieces were originally conceived for First Lady Suite, because as someone said, all of these are as much about the First Ladies as about the First Daughters. Mm-hmm. But they're all fascinating characters, and the stories are the embodiment of these women by these extraordinary actresses. I thought it was great that the two, as someone pointed out, two of the Trinas from various versions of falsettos.
That's right, yeah.
Are in it, Barbara Walsh and Allison Fraser. Allison, I completely agree. I adore her. She, many people have commented on that Lansbury thing. I think that's a great idea. I hope it happens soon. And not only does she look like her, but there's a vocal similarity, I think, as well. So I think that would be great. But in the meantime, I guess through, well, today we're recording on the 22nd, the show's closing, but I think this show is going to have another life. I hope it does. As I've said before, I've always loved Lacuse's stuff. His earlier stuff, a lot of people felt was not melodic enough. I think it was always melodic, but now he writes, I would say, longer melodies, and maybe you get to hear them repeated more, so they stick in your head. There was so much beautiful music in this.
Oh, yes.
Really, really beautiful. And you know, I mean, I think there's a special place in the pantheon for people who are composers and lyricists. I always think that to be able to do both of those jobs really well is a gift from wherever, you know, whatever higher power you believe in. And he certainly does. So I loved it. And the staging was amazing down at the Public. And I'm glad it wasn't a proscenium setup, because that really seemed to add to it. And every single person in it was great, and the direction was fantastic, and I loved it.
Rachel Bay Jones really impressed me. When she was playing Laura Bush in the final scene, I really thought that was Laura Bush up there.
And so different from her performance in Pippin.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, completely, like, completely. Yeah, so,
yeah, playing the demure woman. it was really, really surprising just how fully she seemed to transform into Laura Bush. And I'm not as familiar with Lacuse's music as I'd like to be, and as I've been told by many people that I should be. But it was really nice to hear such lush music, such lush orchestrations. Just, I remember watching Giant and thinking the same thing, just wow, just getting completely swept away in that kind of music. It's kind of similar to seeing an opera in a way.
Yes, and he is able to, I mean, some people write through composed shows just because they don't want to have books in their shows and they don't want to deal with a book writer, but Michael Johns through composed shows, which this one is for the most part, except for, I guess there was that major exception of the, wasn't it the Nancy Reagan scene that had a lot of dialogue in it?
Yes.
Oh, the Nancy on the chairs?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that was a huge book scene, yeah.
But that only pointed up how, you know, the through composition of the rest of the show is so natural that you almost don't realize, hey, everyone's singing all the time. So I think that's another achievement.
I mean, that's the world I want to live in.
Yeah, exactly.
I am looking at the Shikaboom website, and I see that the First Daughter Suite is scheduled for release, that they are recording it. It's all set. Let's see if they have a release date on it, but I'll have the link to that in the show notes so you can check that out. So they're recording it. I was looking to see if they had the First Lady Suite recorded. Do you know if that was recorded?
I think it was. I hope so.
I can't find it anywhere, but maybe it's just my lack of Google skills.
You know what else I kind of wish he had? The only thing I wish is that he had included Sasha and Malia.
Yeah.
and Michelle, maybe he'll add it for the next iteration of this show.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll talk with Kurt over at Shikaboom and see if, as the First Order Suite is going to be released, if we can get Michael on and talk about it. That'd be a lot of fun.
Ask him what he'll write if Hillary Clinton's elected. Will Bill Clinton get his own show?
I was just going to say I think that the Clintons would get their own show. Although, as I'm on the Shikaboom website, I see that
the Clinton musical
has got its cast recording is it out? Yes, it's out. $14.99 at Shikaboom. The original recording of Clinton is available now on the U.S. digital outlets and arrives in international digital outlets on November 20th. So yeah.
I never made it to that show.
Yeah, Carrie Butler supposedly was an excellent Hillary Clinton. So perhaps if Hillary gets elected, Carrie will have a whole line of work in front of her, as though she does. She already has a ton of work in front of her already.
Well, and Carrie's considerably younger than Hillary, so she has a lot of opportunity to still play to play the part.
Lifetime movie.
Oh gosh!
All right. So, what's coming up, Michael? You're going to take a trip down to Red Bank, New Jersey. What are you going to see?
I'm going to see an all-male production of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which sounds, just based on the cast alone, sounds like it could be really something. It's got Christopher Fitzgerald, Michael Urie, David Turner, and Eddie Cooper. And I, you know, on the one hand, it's going to be interesting because Forum is many things, but one thing it is it's kind of a spoof of burlesque. So to see that without women, it'll be interesting to see how they handle that humor, that, you know, all that humor aspect of it, you know, the va-va-va-voom factor. but then, of course, it also has, as part of the plot anyway, it has a man in drag at one point. Hysterium dresses up as the Virgin. The Virgin who's going to be sacrificed. So I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like it could be really interesting. And it's at the Two River Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. And folks, you might want to get to it if you have a chance. It's not hard to get to from via New Jersey Transit from Penn Station. And the tickets are, I would say, less than half price compared to what you would pay on Broadway. So, and it's a lovely theater, lovely town, lovely theater. So I highly recommend looking into it.
So that's I'll put link to that in the show notes as well. And when after you see that, we'll get a review on that and see if it met the expectations, perhaps. Yeah. Also in the news this week, we had the announcement that Cameron McIntosh has decided to bring Miss Saigon into Broadway, the current revival that's playing in London. And we've talked a number of times about this. Did Peter review it when he went to London, or did we just talk about it? Do you remember, Michael?
I don't know, but I remember there was a discussion of Eva Noblezada.
Yes.
Because she was discovered for the role, apparently, in the Jimmy Awards, which we discussed last week with Telly Leung, because he's involved with the Jimmy Awards, the National High School Musical Theater Awards. And that's where, apparently, she was noticed. And as Telly put it, you know, next thing you know, she's starring in Miss Saigon in London. And now, soon on Broadway.
Well, I don't know about soon. Spring 2017. So,
yeah. Okay.
I mean, yeah. I guess 18 months will be here in a blink, and we'll be talking about the Saigon revival.
I wonder why do you suppose such a delay?
You know, the thing is that. I don't know if Cameron wants a specific house for it. I don't. But the thing is that the word out of London was it wasn't selling great in London, and maybe they're going to retool it a little bit. I don't know what the deal is there. But you know, it's Cameron McIntosh has got a will to do something, and it usually gets done. So it might be a combination of retooling and picking out the right house, but we'll see what happens. But the thing to note is that it has announced a limited run on Broadway, and that it is, after its Broadway stop, it's going to go out on a national tour.
Right.
And so it's kind of, you know, what Disney announced with Newsies, isn't that? What they...
Yes.
You know, Disney announced 100 days of Newsies on Broadway, and what did it turn into, a year and a half or so or something?
Yes.
Two years or whatever. So maybe that's the new marketing thing is to say, you know, oh my goodness, it's such a hit that we'll have to extend our Broadway. We'll launch a national tour with a second company, or that, you know, it was always announced that we were going to close and go out on the national tour, so that it has nothing to do with ticket sales. So we'll see what happens. And also hot in the news, you know, if you missed the bandwagon of getting your Hamilton tickets A new block of Hamilton tickets went on sale, so you can get your Hamilton tickets probably for 2017 as well now. So, and that the if the new hot show is supposedly something at New York Theater Workshop, is production of Lazarus, the David Bowie type of he wrote the music for the show. So, the music for Lazarus is mostly existing music, but there's going to be a few songs that are penned just for the show. So, Carrie, you said you're scheduled to go see Lazarus?
Yes, December 5th.
December 5th, so you have to come back after and let us know if we need to start, you know, ordering tickets right now or saving money for it.
Yeah, I was excited to get my invitation. It's been such a mysterious, secretive production, and after I invited a friend to be my plus one, the next thing I knew, he was tweeting manically that I had invited him to Lazarus. I was getting all these email alerts of jealous.
And did we discuss the whole what they're doing to try to cut down on scalping as much as they can?
No.
Well, apparently, now I'm not, don't officially quote me here because I might make sure I got it right, but apparently if you order tickets, you can't actually pick them up until just before the performance. You can't print them out because they think that will cut down on resales.
So that's like a jobs program because they'll have to hire 10 more people for the box office for the night of the show, not to cause everybody showing up at 8:05 to pick up their tickets.
Well, I mean, I when you think about it, it's quite a small theater, they know who's supposed to be there, so they could have everything pre-printed. It's just they're not giving them to them until you know. So and yes, you could still show up like 2 hours before and pick them up and then stand outside and sell them. But I guess it's doing what they can to prevent people from profiteering and not actually. They're trying to get it so that tickets into the hands of people who actually want to see the show.
Yeah, no, that's good because, you know, we've all come up against shows that are just seemingly controlled by the scalpers. Mm. And what are you going to do at that point, you know? Mm-hmm. Also in the news, we might want to talk about Mr. Riedel's column on Al Pacino's China Doll and all the problems that have seemingly gone into that. Have you guys got your invites for China Doll yet?
Yeah.
I've seen it on the 3rd.
On the 3rd, so you're a couple of weeks away. When am I working seeing on? I'm seeing King Charles this week.
Loved that show.
I'm seeing China Doll on the 3rd. Thursday night the 3rd, yeah.
I'm seeing it on the 10th, so you'll beat me. But we'll be talk about that.
See Carrie at the... see Carrie at the theater there that night. And then School of Rock, I'm seeing it on Friday the 11th. And we will... When's the official opening for School of Rock? Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't.
If only there were a website that I ran that had this information. Let's see. I do. Oh, December 10th is The Color Purple. School of Rock's December 6th. China Doll official has been moved to December 4th. Illusionist November 19th, but I don't know if we consider The Illusionist another opening because it seems like it's going to be the same show, but I'm not positive about that.
It has been pointed out it's highly unusual for a show to open on a Friday because of when the reviews come out.
China Doll, yeah.
Yeah, and they said that was there was one other date that they wanted and it conflicted with someone else and that was the only one that was that made sense for them. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what they said. Or you know, the cynical interpretation is that they tried to downplay what the reviews will be.
Oh, awesome. Hey, and what was I just going to say? I was going to say it and I lost my head. Fiddler on the Roof just started their previews. And so they open on December 20th. And next Sunday, which is the 29th of November, we're going to be interviewing Jessica Hecht. So Jessica is in the revival of Fiddler, and I'm very excited that we will talk with her next week.
Can I just say I've been listening to Fiddler preparatory to seeing it again, because it really is, as I've said many times, it's such a masterpiece. But also specifically, the song Matchmaker, Matchmaker, I mean, I don't think that probably that would come up on a short list of the greatest songs ever written for the musical theater, just because, you know, people wouldn't think of it, but it really is. It's incredible. It's a masterpiece. When you think about what's happening in that song, it sets up the what's going to turn out to be the conflict. The two daughters are really looking forward, they think, to having the matchmaker pick someone for them to marry, and it's the tradition, and they don't question it. And then the older daughter is the one who says, well, you know, you might not get exactly what you you are expecting, and then look what happens in the show. But it's so beautifully done, because it's an optune, it's a fast waltz, there's a lot of joy in the song, and yet it sets up what's going to turn out to be a really, you know, serious conflict in the show. So I think that is brilliant.
I was at the Fiddler on the Roof press day, and the three sisters performed that song, and Sheldon Harnick said to them afterwards that he'd never seen it done the way they did it, and that he finally understood why the word terrified was used.
Yes, there was actually, I don't know if you guys saw it, there was a wonderful interview with Sheldon in the Times, and they quoted him saying that.
I can't wait to see it. I've never seen Fiddler live.
Really? Wow.
I didn't live here during the 2004 revival.
It wasn't good. It wasn't good.
But I love everything that I've seen Bart Sher do, and Danny Burstein's probably my favorite living stage actor. I can't wait.
Yes.
He's wonderful. All right. So I'm going to wrap it up. Do you guys have anything left to mention before we go?
Nope.
I think that's it.
All right, so I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. One of the ways that you can listen to us is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get this streamed directly to you. Of course, Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Saturdays at 2 p.m., and Thursdays at 7 p.m. Contact information for Michael, for Carrie, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we talked about before. Through the miracle of technology, it is now Sunday night, and Peter has returned from his trip to Boston. Mm-hmm. Peter, did you have a good trip?
I did. I saw a Confederacy of Dunces at the Huntington Theater Company, and also a community theater production of Follies that was terrific. So a good time was had by all.
Great. We'll talk a little about those next week, but why don't we throw out the answer to the trivia from 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I was talking about the fact that there's a song that suddenly stops in a 60s musical, and there's a line of dialogue, "Why Brown," that belongs there, and it wasn't there, that it was excised for the recording. So what was this? And it comes from The Apple Tree, and it's a convoluted reason why it happened. Originally, in the first segment of The Apple Tree, there were three. It was Adam and Eve, and Adam takes Eve into his cabin. He doesn't want to, but he does. And she looks around, and the first thing she says is, "Adam, why brown?" You know, so already a woman is redecorating an apartment. You know, so that was the joke there. Then in the second story, which is based on The Lady of the Tiger, there's a lyric in which the princess's inamorata says, "We'll live in a house painted brown." And in the show, she actually, Barbara Harris, turned to us directly, to the audience, and said, "Why brown?" So, and we laughed at the joke because, of course, it was a running joke at that point because we had heard the setup. But, you know, I really do believe they should have put in that line of dialogue, because it's so strange to have the music just stop and there's a little whimsical orchestration move there that's supposed to indicate something funny has just happened. But, you know, we didn't have to have the setup at the beginning when you think of it, because why brown? We would know that she was complaining about the color of the house. So what difference does that make? I mean, we know that the same principle is in effect. A woman is complaining about the color that her husband has chosen for where they're going to live. So I'm sorry that Gottfried Lieberson, if indeed he did the album, I assume he did, cut that out. I think it's a little confusing without it. So that's the answer to that question. Now you know.
All right. So what about a new question for this week?
Sure. Once upon a time, the two longest-running musicals in Broadway history shared something else. Each had a character that had the same occupation. This was a featured character in the longer running of the two, and the lead character in the shorter running of the two. What are the shows? What are the occupations?
All right. So if you have the answer to those questions, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. That way we can tell you next week if you had the right answer. So, Peter, looking forward to seeing you next week, where we will have Jessica Heck joining us.
Oh, isn't that nice? Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, she's terrific, so it'll be good. Let me also say that John Baccarella and John Moss both got the answers to the question. At least they emailed me. You might have had some others as well.
Yes.
They're the ones I've heard from, so there.
All righty.
All right, we'll talk next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Carrie Purcell, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Maybe I could wander down the drive to the gate. Maybe I could wander to the gate. Maybe I should wander through the gate.